You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 39, East and West. Thanks for joining me. We last left the narrative in late 1797. The War of the First Coalition was over. French and Austrian diplomats were hammering out a permanent peace treaty. Only Great Britain remained at war with the Republic. Infighting within the French government finally erupted into open confrontation during the coup of Fructidor. The majority faction within the Directory purged their enemies within the executive and cracked down on resurgent royalism. The government was safe and stable once again, but they had relied on troops from the Army of Italy to secure their position, which set a troubling precedent. Napoleon Bonaparte's position on the national political stage was stronger than ever. He was the most famous and popular soldier in France. His public image was of an energetic, civic-minded patriot who had worked tirelessly to deliver peace to the country he loved. Behind the scenes, he was beginning to eclipse his nominal superiors. As his power and influence grew, the true scale of Napoleon's ambition became clearer. In exchange for his help with the coup, Napoleon had demanded a free hand to negotiate peace with Austria himself, without oversight from Paris. We've seen him chip away at the Directory's control over foreign policy in the past. After Fructidor, that takeover was complete. When the coup was sprung in September, negotiations had been underway at the village of Campo Formio in northeastern Italy for over 4 months, and had gotten precisely nowhere. This was not by accident. The French and Austrians couldn't agree on much in 1797, but one goal both sides shared was dragging out the negotiations until the political situation changed in Paris. Everyone at Campo Formio knew the Directory was divided internally and facing a potentially fatal challenge from the conservatives. The Austrians hoped to stall negotiations long enough that the royalists might take power before they were forced to sign an unfavorable peace deal. Surely a new conservative government would be more conciliatory and less eager to hold on to the gains of the Republic. The French negotiators were stalling because they had no clear instructions from Paris, because there was no consensus whatsoever within the government as to what France wanted from the treaty. Even as the French envoys were months into negotiations with the Habsburgs, the directors were still debating basic, fundamental aspects of their policy towards Austria. The result was a farce. Months of pointless meetings in which any remotely important topic was studiously avoided. The coup of Fructidor changed everything. It destroyed the Austrians' hope that a new regime might come to power and save them from suffering the full consequences of their defeat. The coup also silenced the dissenting voices within the French government and put the negotiations in the hands of one man, Napoleon Bonaparte, who had a clear vision for the final treaty. The Austrians were negotiating from the weaker position and facing a brash young general who was inexperienced in the subtle arts of diplomacy, and so they resolved to draw things out, wear Bonaparte down, and drown him in details. Every day they prolonged the talks was another day to rebuild their military and improve their negotiating position. Napoleon was having none of it. He knew what he wanted from the treaty. He knew France had the stronger position, and so he resolved to be just as aggressive and relentless at the negotiating table as he was on the battlefield. Above all, Napoleon knew France was prepared to go back to war if necessary, and Austria was not. He began loudly preparing the army of Italy for a new campaign, knowing full well this news would reach Vienna, and hopefully light a fire under the Austrian negotiators. On October 6th, he wrote a letter to one of his underlings, quote, "The negotiations are almost broken off. The Austrians demand too much. Send me money with all diligence. Dip into all the coffers, for we must have some immediately. In 12 days, we shall be back on campaign. Tell the Brescians and the Cisalpine Republic that unless they furnish money, I shall leave them in the lurch and make peace without them. Signed, Bonaparte. P.S. Money, money, money." End quote. As the army of Italy prepared for war, diplomatic niceties went out the window in Campo Formio. It was now October. If the negotiations were to fail and France had to return to war, Napoleon preferred it happen sooner rather than later. Soon, the Alps would be too cold and snowy to cross. If the negotiations failed in October, he could still order the army of Italy into the field and hopefully be at the gates of Vienna before the new year. If they failed in December, he would have to wait, and the Austrians would have even more time to prepare their defenses and rebuild their depleted armies. He had to force the issue. He wrote back to Paris, quote, "In 2 or 3 days, everything will be settled, one way or the other." End quote. When the Austrians resisted, he battered down their objections with feigned anger and threats. At one particular impasse, Napoleon stood up from the table, shouting, quote, "Damn you! You want war? You shall have it!" End quote. Then he stormed out. On another occasion, he grabbed a priceless porcelain dish off a mantle and smashed it on the ground, exclaiming, quote, "That is what will become of your Austrian monarchy within 3 months, I promise." End quote. These displays had the desired effect. Once Napoleon's brashness forced the Austrians to start negotiating in earnest, the talks only lasted a few weeks. On October 27th, 1797, France and Austria signed the Treaty of Campo Formio, formally ending the war that had begun way back in April of 1792. All of the senior negotiators signed the treaty with their full names and titles, except Napoleon, who left a short autograph in huge script, simply Bonaparte. When the war began, that would have meant nothing. His name wasn't even Bonaparte, it was Buonaparte, and hardly anyone knew it. Now, his power and reputation had grown to the point that his surname carried enough weight to stand alone, unadorned by noble title or military rank. The Treaty of Campo Formio contained 20 clauses, plus 14 secret articles, which were a standard part of diplomatic agreements until after World War I. I won't read it in full because it's long and written in flowery and legalistic prose, but I should mention a few highlights. The Austrian Netherlands, basically modern-day Belgium, were annexed by France. The Habsburgs renounced all territorial claims on the sister republics of northern Italy and recognized them as independent states. The Austrian emperor also agreed to convene a congress in his capacity as Holy Roman Emperor, with the understanding that this congress would validate the French annexation of the west bank of the Rhine and add some more territory to the Batavian Republic, France's Dutch sister republic. I realize that last one might be a bit hard to understand. Basically, this was just another annexation, but France and Austria had to jump through some legal hoops to make it legitimate, due to the weirdness of the Holy Roman Empire, which was technically a confederation of sovereign states, not a part of the Habsburg realms themselves. This was a steep price to pay for the Austrians, even taking into account the scale of the war and the magnitude of their defeat. Just as Napoleon had predicted months earlier, they would not accept it without compensation in the form of new territory elsewhere. He had fabricated an excuse to seize the Republic of Venice for just this purpose, and, sure enough, he signed over most of its former territory to the Habsburgs. I'd say this annexation of Venice was the first big, public black mark on Napoleon's record. 18th-century geopolitics was a merciless dog-eat-dog world, and this wasn't totally without precedent. but it was certainly a dirty move, even by the standards of the day. Venetian neutrality was never quite as neutral as it claimed, but its leadership had quite clearly and deliberately avoided conflict with France. Even if you took Napoleon's version of events at face value, the pretext to occupy Venice was quite flimsy, and certainly not enough to justify the complete annexation of the entire country. Worse, not only did Bonaparte erase Venice from the map, he signed it right over to the Habsburgs. French propaganda claimed this whole war had been an ideological struggle against feudal tyranny. They had rallied their own people and like-minded radicals all over Europe around the banner of an idealistic crusade. Now, France was ending this so-called crusade by behaving just like the old regime great powers, consigning hundreds of thousands of people who lived in former Venetian territories to live under one of the most powerful and conservative monarchs in all of Europe, paying them no more regard than a chess player gives to the pawn he sacrifices to capture a knight. If Bonaparte was here to defend his actions, I'm sure he'd say this was the price to realize France's aims, that the best way to advance the cause of the revolution was to secure the territorial gains of the war by any means necessary, even if it meant compromising some of the Republic's loftier ideals. Not a bad counter-argument, but the fact remained, it didn't look good. Napoleon was an idealist in his youth, a sensitive young man who believed passionately in putting his high-minded Enlightenment philosophies into practice. That side of him never died completely, but the trials and disappointments of the Revolution and the war hardened him, and taught him to subordinate his idealistic impulses to cold, rational calculation. We still see flashes of the young Napoleon, the bookish young lieutenant who joined the Jacobins and had once dreamed of becoming an Enlightenment essayist, one of the Corsican Gracchus brothers whose naive radicalism so annoyed their idol, Pauli. But at Campo Formio, we can clearly see that idealism has been tempered by dispassionate pragmatism. This conflicting mix of the progressive idealism of his youth and these tendencies towards utilitarian realpolitik drilled into him by the hardships and upheavals of his early 20s is a big part of what makes Napoleon such a contradictory and compelling character. There's another important aspect to the Treaty of Campo Formio I'd like to discuss. The document pledged permanent and inviolable peace between France and Austria, but those were just words. In substance, the agreement all but guaranteed future conflict between the two powers. Let me explain it this way. When negotiating a peace treaty, a good diplomat generally doesn't seek to simply grab as much as they can for their country. They want to create a durable new status quo. That means envisioning the interests of other countries, including the former enemy, and imagining how each country might operate diplomatically in the post-treaty environment. The goal is not only to bring peace, but to create a stable, durable peace, a new equilibrium in which the great powers can pursue their interests without coming into conflict and touching off a new war. That meant resolving the underlying causes of the war and ensuring no one left the negotiating table with unfinished business. Now, this isn't all about peace, love, and understanding. 18th century diplomats were always trying to create a harmonious balance of power in which their country held the advantage. But this idea of stability, in which more or less equal alliances between the great powers balanced off one another, was a cornerstone of European diplomacy. Before they lost control of the negotiations, the directors back in Paris sought to pursue this type of peace with Austria. They wanted Western Germany within France's sphere of influence, and in exchange would surrender French gains in Italy, leaving the peninsula solidly within the Habsburg sphere of influence. France and Austria had been rivals for over a century. There were two obvious flashpoints of conflict between the two countries, the struggle for control over the Rhine and the competition for influence in Italy. Theoretically, if France was able to eliminate all Austrian influence from the Rhineland, while giving the Habsburgs a free hand in Italy, those underlying conflicts would be resolved, and the rivalry would evaporate. It all sounds nice, but there were good reasons to believe it wouldn't have worked. Franco-Austrian rivalry went much deeper than a few territorial conflicts along their shared borders. The whole European balance of power was out of whack. France was not quite strong enough to act as the sole hegemon over the entire continent, but not quite weak enough to be considered just another one of several comparable European powers. To create a lasting peace, France would have to either become powerful enough to dominate its rivals and enforce peace, or become weak enough for a stable balance of power to emerge. Even with Napoleon dictating the terms, there was no way the Treaty of Campo Formio alone could have catapulted France to the status of a continental hegemon. Thus, a lasting peace was impossible, or so the theory goes. This was more or less Napoleon's view. At Campo Formio, he negotiated like a soldier, grabbing any strategic advantage he could, exploiting Austria's weakness to impose a permanent upper hand on a country he still considered a hostile rival. He took a big bite out of Austrian influence in both Germany and Italy, but left them a foothold in both theaters. The flashpoints for the Franco-Austrian rivalry remained. Sure enough, the two countries almost immediately found themselves coming into conflict over their overlapping spheres of influence. Looking at this, you might think Napoleon simply wasn't a skilled diplomat, and made amateur mistakes. We will certainly see some evidence for this later in his career, but I don't think that's what's going on at Campo Formio. Napoleon simply wasn't trying to avoid future conflict with Austria. He considered another war against the Habsburgs inevitable, and not necessarily undesirable. The way he saw it, there was too much unfinished business between the two powers to create a long-standing peace, and since France was currently the stronger power, better to let that happen and beat them again. In this way of thinking, the Treaty of Campo Formio was little more than a temporary ceasefire, to be used only to gain advantage for the next round of fighting, and to give the Republic a chance to face Britain without any distractions on the continent. When you look at the treaty from this perspective, Napoleon's approach looks very logical. Bonaparte himself explained his thinking this way, quote, "I have no doubt the critics will deprecate the treaty I have just signed, but all those who know Europe and understand the nuances of negotiation will be convinced that it was impossible to arrive at a better treaty without recommencing hostilities and conquering two or three provinces from Austria. Was that possible? Yes. Was that probable? No. The Austrians are dull and greedy. No people are less conniving or less dangerous to our domestic affairs than the Austrians. The English, on the contrary, are conniving, energetic, and generous with their money. Our government must therefore destroy the British monarchy, or expect to be destroyed itself by the corruption of these scheming and enterprising islanders. The present moment offers us a first-rate opportunity. Let us concentrate all our efforts into the maritime, and destroy England. With that done, Europe will be at our feet." End quote. So, there you have it. Napoleon saw Campo Formio not as a chance for a permanent settlement with Austria, but an opportunity to buy the time France needed to neutralize its more dangerous enemy. It's a very perceptive comment. As the Napoleonic Wars rage on, we'll see how British intrigues and British money did indeed doom revolutionary France, just as Napoleon predicted. This is generally how Bonaparte approached diplomacy. As long as France's enemies stood standing, he operated under the assumption that another war was inevitable. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. For now, just take note. The Franco-Austrian rivalry was still simmering. The Treaty of Campo Formio merely set the stage for the next conflict on the continent.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Shifting gears, there is one last aspect to the treaty we need to discuss, because it provides the segue into the next chapter of our story. Not all of the former Venetian territory was annexed by the Austrians. Napoleon had insisted on a few exceptions, which would be annexed instead by France. Article 5 of the treaty reads, quote, His Majesty the Emperor, King of Hungary and Bohemia, consents that the French Republic shall possess in complete sovereignty the former Venetian islands of the Levant, to wit, Corfu, Zante, Cephalonia, Santa Maura, Cerigo, and other islands dependent upon them, as well as Butrinto, Arta, Vonitsa, and in general all the former Venetian establishments in Albania, which are situated below the Gulf of Drin. End quote. At first glance, this is probably the least important provision of the whole treaty. It's an impressive-sounding list, but if you trace it on a map, we're talking about a disconnected string of insignificant islands and coastal enclaves, the largest of which was under 800 square kilometers, or about 300 square miles. In terms a modern person might recognize, we are talking about the Ionian Islands of modern-day Greece, plus a small strip of land on the coast of modern-day Albania. During the Venetian Golden Age and the Renaissance, these were important outposts in a powerful, lucrative maritime empire that vied for control over the eastern Mediterranean, which was the crossroads of trade between the rising powers of Europe and the wealthy East. But by 1797, the streams of international trade had all moved west, leaving these tiny Venetian outposts high and dry, commercially and strategically insignificant, and of little intrinsic economic value. When Napoleon made a point of demanding these small, useless outposts for France, the Austrians did little to resist. Bonaparte was quite adamant, and they had little interest in these poor, useless islands anyway. Better to save their energy to fight him on a more important provision of the treaty. It wasn't immediately obvious, but Napoleon had a good reason to secure these outposts. He had a long-term vision for projecting French power into the eastern Mediterranean. He needed as many footholds as possible in the region if he was going to realize those plans. On September 13th, Bonaparte wrote a fateful letter to Paris. Quote, "It will be necessary to seize upon Egypt. We could sail from here with 25,000 men, escorted by 8 or 10 ships, and take the country." End quote. The addressee of this letter was France's foreign minister, who had only been on the job for a few months. His name was Charles-Maurice de Talleyrand-Périgord, generally known in English simply as Talleyrand. Of all the conniving backroom operators in the Directory, Talleyrand was perhaps the wiliest, and the most unscrupulous. He was unpopular, uncharismatic, and utterly corrupt, but effective and fiendishly intelligent. No one could match him when it came to intrigue and bureaucratic infighting. He will soon become one of the most important characters in our story, so I'll wait and give him a proper introduction when the time comes. For now, the most important thing to know about Talleyrand is that he too was interested in Egypt. On July 3rd, 1797, only 2 months before receiving Napoleon's letter, Talleyrand published an essay titled, quote, "On the Advantages to be Derived from New Colonies Under the Present Circumstances," end quote. As you can probably guess from that long-winded 18th-century title, the essay argued for the acquisition of new colonies, particularly in land close to France, and thus easy to control, and with warm climates, which might be amenable to the production of lucrative cash crops. In Talleyrand's assessment, the place which best fit the bill was Egypt. The idea of an expedition to Egypt now had two powerful, energetic advocates. Talleyrand, who was high-placed in the civilian government, and Napoleon, who was high-placed in the military, key ingredients in turning essays and ambitions into state policy. So, you might be asking yourself, why Egypt of all places? The French had just finished fighting a war against most of Western Europe. Why were they already getting ready to pick another fight, hundreds of miles away, on a different continent? As is often the case with government policy, there was no one single rationale behind the expedition to Egypt, but a whole host of reasons, none of which on their own constituted an impetus for action, but taken all together and combined with the ambitions of powerful men, created enough momentum to bring a plan into fruition. First off, let's take a look at some of the strategic reasons for the expedition. In late 1797, France had one big strategic problem. Great Britain remained at war with the Republic, and that conflict was in a stalemate, with no hope of quick resolution. Britain was primarily a maritime power. France was primarily a land power. Neither side could challenge the other's sphere of dominance. Meanwhile, the Royal Navy wreaked havoc on Republican merchant shipping. This was a major factor driving up the price of food in France. The government was desperate to force the British to the negotiating table, but how? Britain enjoyed near-total naval supremacy in the English Channel. Invading the island directly was out of the question. Paris needed some way to strike an indirect blow against the British. Something short of an invasion that would threaten the British strategic position enough that they might consider peace. French strategists had reason to believe seizing Egypt might do the trick. Egypt is about halfway between the United Kingdom and its most important colony, India, which by now was roughly half under British control and already paying huge dividends. The long, tenuous postal route that carried dispatches between British India and the mother country passed through Egypt. This circuit was also popular for commerce between Europe and India. There was no Suez Canal yet, but merchants could move their goods overland between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, bypassing the long, dangerous voyage around the whole African continent. Seizing Egypt and disrupting these networks could threaten the British hold on India enough that they might contemplate ending the war. If not, Egypt could provide a springboard for further offensives into the region, raiding shipping along the sea route to India, sending money and supplies to Indian princes who were fighting the British, or even a French invasion of India itself. The strategic standoff with the British was the most urgent, immediate rationale for the expedition. But French policymakers had been interested in Egypt for decades, since long before the War of the First Coalition. We have evidence of the idea being discussed as far back as the reign of Louis XIV, at the dawn of the 18th century. The Duke of Choiseul, who was chief minister under Louis XV, actually drafted a plan to invade Egypt way back in the 1760s, but he was never able to interest the king. So what long-term interests did French leaders see in Egypt? For starters, they saw what all colonialists see: money. It's hard to overstate how lucrative colonial cash crops were in the 18th century economy. And not only did the colonial trade generate money in and of itself, it fostered the growth of the shipping, manufacturing, and financial sectors of the economy, which all European governments of this era were keen to encourage. You might compare it to modern governments desperate for ways to encourage the growth of their country's high-tech and e-commerce sectors. At the dawn of the Revolution, more than two-thirds of France's international commerce was with her own colonies, and perhaps as many as one out of every five jobs in France was either directly or indirectly linked with the colonial trade. Egypt had a warm climate and plenty of rich soil in the Nile Valley, important geographical conditions for cash crop farming. It also had a large population, which meant cheap labor and a fruitful market for French manufactured goods. Egypt also had the advantage of being relatively near France, three times closer than the colonies in the Caribbean, and over much calmer seas. Above all, there was the tantalizing prospect of digging a canal to connect the Red Sea and the Mediterranean. French policymakers hoped this could reroute a significant portion of all of the trade between Europe and the East, from the Atlantic to the Mediterranean. In theory, this would make France's southern ports the gateway to all of Western Europe, and steer commerce away from the British-dominated Atlantic. In the long term, this realignment might allow France to surpass Britain as Europe's leading commercial power. And without their dominance over global trade, Britain might easily sink to the status of a secondary power. By the late 18th century, French merchants were already making inroads into Egypt. When Napoleon arrived in Alexandria in 1798, there were about 60 French traders resident in the city. Expanding those existing trade networks would be much easier than creating them from scratch. But as the revolution loomed, all was not well in this small community of French merchants in Alexandria. As British influence in India grew, so too did their interest in Egypt. More and more British merchants and colonial officials passed through Egypt, and some of them stayed to conduct business. For years, French businessmen had been the main conduit of European commerce into Egypt, but they began to find themselves losing ground to the British. As merchants typically do in such scenarios, they accused their British competitors of accepting unfair political assistance from London, and sent complaints back to Paris demanding their own government step in to level the playing field. On their own, a few dozen complaints from some merchants in a foreign country didn't rank very high on the French government's list of priorities. But taken in context with France's pre-existing interest in Egypt and their rivalry with Britain, the plight of the French traders in Alexandria became one more rationale for the expedition. So, to sum up, there were a lot of concrete strategic and economic reasons for France to invade Egypt, but there was also a less tangible, harder to quantify motivation behind the expedition, something more on the emotional and even the spiritual side of the spectrum. Among the French elite, the mystique of ancient Egypt and the allure of the exotic unknown East were a powerful attraction. This was a relatively new phenomenon. Throughout the Renaissance, the East was mostly an object of fear for Europeans. The Ottoman Empire was in its golden age, a rising tide that seemed destined to engulf Christian Europe. The Ottomans annihilated Christian armies and ate up Christian states. The few Western victories over the Turks felt more like temporary stays of execution than permanent checks on Ottoman expansion. To Europeans of the Renaissance era, the East was home to a terrifying and inscrutable threat. Imagine how Americans in the 1950s thought of the Soviet Union, but with an additional layer of ignorance and spiritual panic. However, Ottoman momentum eventually slowed, and over the course of the 18th century, European powers began to surpass the Turks. At the same time, the Enlightenment was calling all old orthodoxies into question, including Europeans' traditional fear and hatred of the East. Those old bigotries never totally vanished, but European intellectuals began to look at the East in a new light. Hatred and fascination are often two sides of the same coin. Discourses on European society, written from the perspective of fictional Middle Easterners, became a popular format for Enlightenment writing. This allowed European thinkers to couch their criticisms of contemporary society behind a layer of plausible deniability, protecting themselves from censorship or persecution. Both Voltaire and Montesquieu used this device. By modern standards, these works were all almost comically ignorant and bigoted, but the idea that Easterners and Eastern ways of thinking might have something to offer the West would have been taboo in earlier eras. Turks, Arabs, Jews, Persians, and other peoples of the Middle East had loomed as villains in the Western imagination for generations. Now that Europeans were broadening their intellectual horizons, it was quite natural that they develop a curiosity about the people and places they'd been taught to fear. And once they started looking, the few glimpses they got from travelers' accounts and translated works of poetry and literature showed that there was a lot to discover. And not only in contemporary Middle Eastern cultures. The cradle of civilization was in Mesopotamia. Greece, the birthplace of Western culture and philosophy, was within the Ottoman Empire, and so very much a part of the East rather than the West. Half of the Roman Empire's territory, and all of Alexander the Great's territory, were in the East as well. Remember, an enthusiasm for all things classical was a big part of the Enlightenment. To Europeans of this era, the so-called Orient was home to the new and exotic, and also to undiscovered ancient knowledge. Its people were frightening and barbaric, but also fascinating. Among the European literati, there was a deep desire to explore these lands, unlock their secrets, and possess them. This was the prehistory of Orientalism, the West's artistic and intellectual fascination with Asia and North Africa, which would become a major force in Western culture in the 19th century. This phenomenon was deeply paternalistic at best, and viciously bigoted at worst. Old, medieval religious prejudices against Islam, polytheism, and Judaism mingled with the emerging ideology of white European racial superiority and the brutal realities of imposing colonial rule to create a hopelessly toxic undertone to the whole movement. But Orientalists didn't devalue or denigrate the East. While they may have held a lot of bigoted attitudes towards its people, they saw the region as a repository of lost knowledge, exotic luxury, and opportunities for personal and spiritual fulfillment through adventure and encounters with the ancient and unfamiliar. These attitudes were just beginning to form as Napoleon planned his expedition. He would deliberately tap into them for his own purposes, and the discoveries made by the French in Egypt would launch Orientalism from a niche elite interest into the forefront of the West's cultural and intellectual consciousness. This is the perfect place to pivot from discussing France's ambitions in Egypt to Napoleon's own personal ambitions for the expedition. As always, Bonaparte had one eye on the French strategic position and another on burnishing his own public image. He'd won fame in Italy, but his reputation still didn't come close to matching the scale of his ambitions. Conquering Egypt was an achievement worthy of Napoleon's dreams. As we've already discussed, Egypt was a huge country with massive economic potential as a colony, and taking it for France would completely upend global trade and geopolitics, spit in the eye of the hated British, and possibly bring the war to an end. Conquering the country would be a major feather in his cap, however you looked at it. And the Orient in general, and Egypt specifically, loomed large in the European imagination. Napoleon himself was an eager participant in the nascent Orientalist cultural trends we just discussed a moment ago. Histories of the East and travelers' accounts from the region were among his favorite books, which he read over and over. Napoleon's personal passion for Orientalism probably played a role in the decision to invade Egypt, but he also understood that he was far from alone in this interest and sought to exploit the wider public enthusiasm for the East. As he planned the invasion, Bonaparte was cultivating a new dimension to his public image. Not only did he want to be seen as a soldier and a patriot, but as a progressive intellectual and a patron of the arts and sciences. When he had held court at the Palace of Montebello as de facto king of Italy, Napoleon had made a point of attracting prominent writers, thinkers, scientists, artists, and mathematicians to be his guests. At Montebello, he formed important, lasting friendships with several major French intellectuals. After the Treaty of Campo Formio, he and Josephine returned to Paris and took up residence in her old house, where they maintained this tradition by holding regular salons. The house had once stood on the Rue Chantraine, but the street was now renamed the Rue de la Victoire, or Victory Street, in honor of the First Italian Campaign, a name it still bears today. Napoleon even got himself elected to the mathematics section of the Institute of France, roughly equivalent to the Royal Society in Britain or the National Academy of Sciences here in the US. He took the seat vacated by Lazare Carnot when the latter fled the country during the coup of Fructidor. It was only fitting to elect another well-connected military man in Carnot's place. Obviously, Napoleon's fame on the battlefield and political clout played the decisive role in his election to the Institute, but modern mathematicians who have looked at his work maintain he was no slouch, and figures as grand as the pioneering chemist Claude Berthollet and Gaspard Monge, the father of modern geometry, respected his abilities. In Egypt, Napoleon aimed to solidify his reputation not only as a soldier and historical figure, but as a champion of the Enlightenment. Educated Europeans were almost unanimous in their desire to explore and catalog the mysteries of the East, and Napoleon would do it. He planned to bring not only soldiers and administrators, but scientists, writers, mathematicians, and engineers. The expedition would not only have political and military dimensions, but scholarly and cultural ones. Napoleon would frame it as much more than a land grab or a strategic move on the global chessboard. This would be a mission for human knowledge and civilization, at least if you believed the propaganda. This intellectual component of the expedition wasn't only a matter of what the French could learn from the East, but also what ideas of their own they might spread in the lands they conquered. We've discussed this concept of an evangelizing mission to spread the ideals of the revolution in past episodes, so I'll try to avoid repeating myself too much. In short, the French had worked to spread their ideology in northern Italy, the Low Countries, and western Germany, and Napoleon's expedition aimed to do the same in Egypt. The Republicans considered the message and promise of the revolution to be universal. They believed it applied to Italians, Dutchmen, and Germans just as much as Frenchmen, and to Middle Easterners just as much as Europeans. Napoleon aimed to win over the hearts and minds of the people, not to rule over them like some despotic colonial viceroy. To this end, he sent agents to scour Europe for an Arabic-language printing press. This turned out to be quite a tall order. There was not much of a market in this part of the world for printed materials in Arabic. They finally tracked one down in Rome, at the offices of the Sacred Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith, a Vatican institution charged with spreading Catholicism in non-Catholic countries. The press was commandeered for the revolution and would go to Egypt to serve a very different purpose. As we saw in Italy, those who were liberated by the French didn't always see them as saviors. In Egypt, cultural, religious, and linguistic divides between Napoleon's army and the local population would be even more stark. On top of that, many Frenchmen harbored bigoted attitudes about non-Christians and non-Europeans. These could be conscious or unconscious, and they could even coexist with genuine altruistic desires to liberate the peoples of the Middle East.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
That takes care of Napoleon's philosophical motivations for the expedition. Now let's take a 180 and talk about some crass political considerations. Back in Paris, the directors were probably restraining themselves from jumping for joy at the prospect of finally getting rid of the troublesome General Bonaparte. From the moment he took command of the Army of Italy, Napoleon had been demanding, meddlesome, and insubordinate. The government had failed to keep him in check at every turn. They had been looking for a way to handle their Bonaparte problem for years, and now he himself was suggesting a solution. The way the directors saw it, sending Napoleon to Egypt had no political downside. If the expedition failed, Napoleon would return to France humbled, with his reputation and popularity greatly diminished. That is, if he survived. If the invasion succeeded, Napoleon's fame would continue to grow, but he would be nearly 2,000 miles away, on another continent, too preoccupied with his conquests and too distant to interfere in politics back in France. Napoleon had his own petty political motivations as well. First, the Treaty of Campo Formio was a mixed blessing to his political ambitions. Napoleon's image as a peacemaker and bringer of victory was a massively important part of his public profile, so in that sense, it was a triumph. However, he was a soldier. His reputation was built on the battlefield, and peacetime provided few opportunities to maintain that reputation. The public has a short memory. With peace, even a general of Napoleon's stature would eventually fade from the hearts of the people. That is, unless he went out and found some other conflict to keep his name in the headlines. Egypt would do quite nicely. Second, Napoleon was probably worried about competing with a fellow Republican general. In earlier episodes, we've met General Lazare Hoche, commander of the Army of the Sambre and Meuse. He's most famous for finally defeating the Royalist Rebellion in the Vendée, but you might remember him more recently as the hardcore Republican who refused to use his troops for the coup of Fructidor. Hoche was probably the second most famous soldier in France after Napoleon. The two generals were not personally hostile or in any direct competition, but the military was now politicized, and their status as popular young army commanders made them de facto rivals. When Napoleon began planning the Egyptian expedition, Hoche was already in charge of a different, ambitious, seaborne operation, an invasion of Ireland. It's often been speculated that Napoleon's sojourn to Egypt was intended, at least in part, to one-up Hoche's plan for Ireland. Obviously, Bonaparte would never admit to such a petty motivation, even in private correspondence, but it certainly wouldn't be out of character. Hoche's expedition left the port of Brest in late December 1796, 43 ships carrying nearly 20,000 soldiers, bound for Bantry Bay in County Cork, on the southwestern corner of the island. Ireland was roiling with rebellion. Inspired by the examples of the French and American revolutions, thousands of Irishmen, both Protestant and Catholic, had joined underground revolutionary societies. These groups were in contact with radical Irish exiles in Paris, and ready to launch an insurrection in support of Osh's invasion. Just as they had done in the Netherlands and in Italy, Osh's army included a cadre of these radical exiles, who would be poised to take charge of this insurrection when the time came. The leader of this cadre was a charismatic young Anglican lawyer from Dublin named Theobald Wolfe Tone, regarded today as the patron saint of Irish nationalism. Britain's standing army was small, and most of its best units were scattered all over the world. Their presence in Ireland was a few second-line troops and hastily raised militia units. With two divisions of seasoned Republican troops and the population on his side, Osh would have every advantage once the army landed. After that, Great Britain itself is only separated from Ireland by about 12 miles, or 19 kilometers, at its closest point. Even the mighty Royal Navy would be hard-pressed to stop a French incursion over such a narrow strait. The expedition showed great promise, if it could land at its destination. Osh and his army left port on December 15th. On December 16th, a message arrived from Paris, canceling the invasion. There were reports of bad weather, and combined with the threat from the British Navy, the risk was deemed too great. It came too late, but the government was right to be cautious. Heavy winds scattered the armada, and the more experienced British Navy began picking off isolated French ships. The weather grew worse, and soon the French fleet was struggling just to stay afloat. Within a few days, around a quarter of their ships were lost, either in storms or by enemy action. Around 3,000 Frenchmen drowned, another 1,000 were taken prisoner. Not a single Republican soldier set foot on Irish soil. As Napoleon planned his own seaborne invasion, this Irish fiasco must have weighed on him heavily. As the incident illustrates, there was a lot that could go wrong. Osh's expedition was a failure, but he remained in command of French troops in Northern Europe, and maintained his connections with the Irish exiles. Napoleon had no way of knowing this would be Osh's only attempt to invade Ireland. But on September 19th, 1797, General Lazar Osh died at his army's camp in western Germany. He was just 29 years old. You occasionally find sources that suggest he was poisoned, but this seems to be little more than poetic license. Osh suffered from tuberculosis during his final years, and death at 29 was sadly quite typical for someone in his condition during this era. Napoleon ordered the Army of Italy to hold a funeral service for General Osh. His name was inscribed on the roll of honor of each division, and Republican anthems were sung. Napoleon specifically requested the Hymn of January 21st, which celebrated the execution of King Louis, and the Song of the Departure, the old Jacobin military anthem, obvious nods to the fallen general's fiery republicanism. Osh would have approved. As I've mentioned before, Napoleon often treated his rivals with surprising grace and magnanimity once he was sure they were out of his way. With Osh gone, there was no one left in the French military whose stature even approached Napoleon's. There were other generals who had shown great skill or bravery on the battlefield, or who had political connections, or who were popular with their men or with the public, but only in Osh and in Napoleon did you find all of these attributes combined in a single personage, with independent command over an army. For the time being, Napoleon had no rivals. It's worth pointing out that Osh died in September of 1797, when the expedition to Egypt was barely more than a glint in Napoleon's eye. There was more than enough time to put the brakes on this whole plan without any loss of prestige. This would almost certainly have been the safe, prudent course of action. If he'd canceled the expedition, he could easily have expected to sit back, bide his time, and watch the natural course of events take him to even greater heights of power. The Directory was weak, unpopular, and prone to make mistakes. And with Britain still at war, and peace on the continent unstable, there would certainly be more opportunities for military glory in Europe before long. But Napoleon didn't take the safe, prudent course of action. It wasn't his nature. Like most politicians, he could be vain and petty when it came to his public image and his political rivalries, but he was much more than a cynical powermonger or preening climber. His core motivations were internal. He didn't measure himself against other people, but against his own personal dreams of greatness. This ideal led him to reach further than most. Now he would follow it to Egypt. He was going for France's strategic interests and imperial ambitions. He was going for the Enlightenment, to spread the ideals of the revolution and feed Europe's lust to unlock the mysteries of the East. He was going for politics, to burnish his own public image, and because the government wanted him gone. Finally, he was going to chase his own dreams of military glory and historical greatness. Egypt was a major milestone in the careers of his idols, Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great. Both men had been changed by Egypt, put on new trajectories by their encounters with this ancient country. Napoleon wanted to test himself, to see if he was worthy to follow in their footsteps, and to encounter the mystique of this place himself, and see how it might change his own destiny. Next time, we'll see Napoleon set sail for the land of the pharaohs, and learn more about the country and the people he would encounter there. Until then, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.